Hello, everybody. This is Michael Marsalek. I'm speaking with Shankar Vedantam. He's the NPR social science correspondent and the host of Hidden Brain, the podcast and the radio show. The program uses science and storytelling to reveal the unconscious patterns that drive human behavior, shape our choices, and direct our relationships. It's an award-winning program with an Edward R. Murrow Award and a number of journalism and science awards as well. Shankar Vedantam is an author as well and has been doing Hidden Brain on NPR for a number of years now. So first of all, thank you so much for taking time to talk with Montana Public Radio.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Your program is new to our air, so in some ways I feel like we're getting a chance to introduce you personally to Montana Public Radio listeners. We know lots of people have been listening to the podcast. I know that Hidden Brain, the podcast, is one of the most popular podcasts out there with more than 2 million people listening every week. Do you think about the show differently than you do the podcast in terms of the audience and how you're crafting what you're going to put on the air every week or put on the podcast every week?
So the interesting thing, Michael, is that Hidden Brain in many ways began on the radio in short conversations I was having on Morning Edition, often with Steve Inskeep or David Green, where we discussed an interesting piece of social science research in conversational form. And it was really the success of that form that prompted us to say, maybe there's a podcast here. Maybe actually people want to hear these ideas in greater depth or at greater length. And what's happened really over the last 2 years is in some ways we've returned to radio, which is where we actually began. And in some ways, I feel like all of these different things feed and inform one another. So the short stories I do on Morning Edition sometimes lead to ideas for the podcast. Ideas for the podcast certainly play an important role in what shows up in the radio show. Our radio listeners sometimes get in touch with us with interesting ideas. They go back into the podcast feed. Things work synergistically in a really wonderful and beautiful way.
Your enthusiasm always comes through. I just love that about, you know, even these conversations that you talked about on Morning Edition, but certainly on the radio show or the podcast. You always seem so curious, and you're speaking to these wonderful guests. Where does this fascination of humanity come from?
That's a great question. All I can tell you is that the fascination I have with the subjects that I'm exploring is completely sincere and genuine. I genuinely feel that the stories that I'm talking about in any given moment are literally the most interesting thing on the planet. I know they're not, but you know, it feels that way to me. And I think in some ways that's a really important part of the success of the show, which is the Hidden Brain team and I are really energized. We love to do what we do, and I think when you love to do what you do, some of that love shows up in the work that you do as well. And I think listeners respond to us, and they're responding, I think, not just to our ideas and not just to our audio and sound production, but they're also listening to the enthusiasm and passion that we bring to our stories. And I think all of those in some ways have helped to make Hidden Brain a success.
I am very fascinated with the psychology of false beliefs. I know you've done programs on this. As we are now in another election cycle and with the ongoing dismissal of science in the world as it relates to things like climate change and other things, what have you learned? And it seems like there's a need to promote science and scientific studies broadly as we go forward to help people be better citizens. Do you think of that as even part of the mission of the show, or how do you approach these things that seem so complicated and polarized in our world right now?
So I think one of the great missions, if you will, of Hidden Brain, or one of its central missions, is really to hold up a mirror to people so that they can see themselves. You know, the mirrors we hold up are not mirrors that show people their bodies or their faces. These are mirrors for the mind. And I think certainly when you look at the question of fake news or alternative facts, as they've sometimes been called, or false beliefs, I think these are really interesting and powerful ways in which our minds work. And in all honesty, I'm not sure Hidden Brain's role is necessarily to tell people, look, you believe something that's right and look, you believe something that's wrong. I don't think our job is to sort of be the arbiter of what's true and what's false, as much as to show people the psychological mechanisms that prompt us to reach the various conclusions that we do. You know, I sometimes tell people that our show is not in the heat business. Our show is in the light business. Our goal is really to give people insight into why things are the way they are, why their minds work the way they do. And then what people take and do with that really is up to them. The question of false beliefs is fascinating because, of course, all of us are keenly aware of the false beliefs of our opponents. But one of the things that's almost universal is that very few of us have any insight into the false beliefs that we ourselves carry around. So there's no one around the world who can't tell you about the false beliefs of their enemies. There are very few people around the world who can tell you about the false beliefs they carry around in their own heads. And one of the fascinating questions is, why is that? Why is it that we have so much insight into other people's false beliefs and so little into our own? So that's the kind of question that fascinates me, not so much is a belief true or is a belief false, but really these psychological mechanisms that prompt us to reach certain conclusions and then defend them in the face of all the evidence.
I often think of it when I listen to the show that you're also giving people tools to think differently about how they're processing whatever might be going on in the world. And I think that seems to be part of it, right?
Indeed, very much so. I mean, so for example, when it comes to false beliefs, one of the interesting things that people have found in research studies is if you sit people before, in very simple experiments, you ask people to sit before a computer screen and pick out, see if they can identify images from what they're seeing on the screen. When there are actual images, everyone has no problem saying, okay, that's a dog, that's a cat, that's a lamppost. But something really interesting happens when the pictures on the screen are basically, just random dots or like the static you see on an old television set. In those situations, when you take your volunteers and you give some of them a feeling that they do not have control over their lives, or you remind them of a time when they did not have control over their lives, the people who lack control are more likely now to see images in the random dots than the people who experience a feeling of control in their lives. Mm. And what that tells me in some ways is that we generate false beliefs partly as a way to compensate for the things that we're experiencing inside our heads. So in other words, when you feel like you're lost, when you feel like you're confused, when you feel like you're overwhelmed, you're likely to see patterns. You're likely to see things that seem to cohere in ways that might not actually be true. When you think about something like a conspiracy theory, for example, on their surface, they seem absurd. And again, when we think about the conspiracy theories of our opponents, we say, how foolish of people to believe this crazy conspiracy theory. But if you think about the conspiracy theory from the point of view of the psychology I just explained, if people feel powerless, if you feel helpless, if you feel that your life is at the mercy of other powerful forces that you do not fully understand, you are far more likely to see patterns, to see, rules or hidden rules in what's happening around you, even when those patterns do not actually exist. And to me, that's fascinating because what it suggests is that the way you overcome these false beliefs is not necessarily by providing people with evidence that tells them, look, your false belief is wrong or you're a moron for believing something that's false. It's really to address the underlying psychological need that's prompting those false beliefs in the first place.
And that the approach that often people take isn't necessarily the one that's going to get through. I mean, that's what you're saying. Right?
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed, yeah. I mean, and this is a very old idea from psychotherapy, right? If someone shows up at a psychotherapist's office, and the person is drinking too much or using drugs or has a gambling problem or is, cheating on his spouse, for example, the first thing the psychotherapist does is not say, look, here are the 12 different things in your life that you're doing wrong and here's what you need to fix. Because the psychotherapist understands the person might not actually have the capacity to even understand what it is that he is doing. And so one of the first things the psychotherapist has to do is to build up trust with the client or the patient and to sort of establish boundaries and sort of say, here's what we are working on today and here's what we're trying to get to. And you try and build up to the solutions, but you don't necessarily hit people over the head with the solutions because you understand that might actually be counterproductive for what you're trying to accomplish.
I'm speaking with Shankar Vedantam today, the host of Hidden Brain from NPR. Shankar, some recent programs and series of programs that you've done have focused on other really big subjects like death and dying, the explosion of the use of social media. Could you talk a little bit about what surprises you or what has surprised you as you dive into these big subjects?
So let's take one of the examples you just gave. We did an episode recently, it was titled Screaming into the Void, looking at the culture of outrage that exists on social media, but also on cable television. Sometimes at 9 o'clock in the night, as an experiment, I like to switch between MSNBC and Fox News. And what's interesting is that you see people who are really livid, but each is livid about the other side. And you switch back and forth between these two channels, and you see alternate pictures of the country country in which we live, and each is completely incomprehensible to the other. And so I think one of the things that we try and do with the show is try and understand, why is it this is happening? Why do you have this culture of outrage, for example, that permeates social media and cable television? One of the things that I found really interesting and insightful from the researchers whom we interviewed for that episode is that when you express outrage in the media, and when you express outrage in a tweet, it's far more likely that that tweet gets shared by other people. So in other words, you get social feedback that expressing outrage is a good thing, and you're more likely now to do it again the next day. But this virality, if you will, comes at a great paradox. And the paradox is, even as your outrage tweet spreads, it's largely spreading within people who are part of your own echo chamber, the people who agree with you in the first place. So in other words, you're getting heard by lots of people, but you're not getting heard by any of the people who disagree with you, who presumably are the people you actually, whose minds you actually want to change. And this actually explains, when you think about it, what on the surface seems like a great paradox, because for the last 10 or 20 years, we've had these virulently partisan media outlets, you know, essentially telling people what to think about the other side. And it really hasn't changed people's opinions all that much. The country is still divided down the middle 50-50. And one potential explanation for this is that each side is primarily talking only to themselves. You're talking within an echo chamber. No one who's outside that echo chamber is even listening to you, let alone is having their minds changed by you.
How does the public broadcasting system support that, help that, fight that phenomenon, do you think?
I mean, in many ways, I think public radio is actually one of the places where you can actually have civil conversation, where we understand that, you know, people can disagree with one another without being disagreeable, as the saying goes, that we can actually listen to one another without necessarily assuming that just because I disagree with you, it means that you're an evil or despicable person. Public radio, in many ways, partly because it's member-supported, because it's actually supported by people in the community, is less vulnerable in some ways to some of the commercial pressures that affect other media outlets that prompt them to care, you know, very intensely about ratings. And I'm not suggesting that public radio doesn't care about its listenership or growing its listenership. Of course we do. But I think in some ways, partly because we are member-supported and we have, you know, the mission of public radio is to create a more informed public. That's part of our mission statement. It allows us, I think, in some ways to have conversations that are more about the light business than about the heat business, which is a way I describe Hidden Brain as a show as well.
Maybe one more question, if you have time. You get to be curious about our world every week, and you get to talk with experts in so many different fields. Can you give us an idea of some of the projects you hope to be working on and some shows that you hope to do in the coming months?
Absolutely. One of the episodes I'm really looking forward to, it's a difficult episode. It's looking at the decisions we make at the end of our lives, how we want to be treated if we are suffering from a terminal illness or we are suffering from a life-threatening injury. And you know, we're relying on other people to make decisions on whether to keep us on life support or withdraw life support. And one of the things we're exploring in the episode is that we're often asked to, you know, make decisions when we're 25 or 35 or 45. And we're asked to say, you know, tell us what you want to see happen if you happen to be in the situation at the end of your life, how you would want to be treated. And the episode is really looking at the idea that perhaps that when we're 25 or 35 or 45, we actually do not have very good insight into how we will feel when we're 75 or 85 or 95, that the people we are at 25 are not the same people we are when we're 85. And so when we ask people, make a decision for your future self, it superficially feels as if you are the same person making the decision for yourself, but you're really making a decision for someone who is effectively another human being, because that person is not the same as you. And we explore some of the implications and dilemmas of this in that episode. One of the other things that we're exploring in the coming weeks looks at the role of psychology and storytelling in economic transactions. We tend to think of the economy as following a fairly rigid set of scientific rules. You know, I buy more if things are less expensive. I buy less if things are more expensive. You know, the Federal Reserve acts if the economy is doing well in raising or lowering interest rates. And we're going to do an episode that really looks at how so much of the economy really functions on questions related to trust or questions related to our perception of how the story of the economy is going. And we're going to feature some ideas from a Nobel Prize-winning economist who's written a new book called Narrative Economics that tries to argue that in some ways, you know, there's a potential that we could talk ourselves into a recession by sort of amplifying the fears and the stories about an economic decline.
And can we expect to still have your regular presence with some regularity on Morning Edition? Is that still part of your plan?
Yes, that is still part of the plan. I am stretched very thin, as you can imagine, producing a weekly podcast and weekly radio show. But I really do enjoy sort of talking with Stephen Skeep and David Green and Rachel Martin and the other hosts on Morning Edition about interesting social science ideas. And it's actually been a very important engine for ideas that eventually come back onto the podcast and the radio show. So I'm certainly hoping to keep doing that as well.
Hidden Brain, the radio show, is on Montana Public Radio Fridays at 7 p.m., and you can hear Shankar Vedantam on Morning Edition as well. Shankar Vedantam is NPR's social science correspondent and the host of Hidden Brain. Thank you so much for talking with us here at Montana Public Radio.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been a pleasure.